The Healer, The Healing Work of Mary Baker Eddy, compiled and arranged by David Keaston. Appendix 1, First Continuation. Healings by Mrs. Eddy in Science and Health. A woman whom I cured of consumption always breathed with great difficulty when the wind was from the east. I sat silently by her side a few moments. Her breath came gently. The inspirations were deep and natural. I then requested her to look at the weather vane. She looked and saw that it pointed due east. The wind had not changed, but her thought of it had, and so her difficulty in breathing had gone. The wind had not produced the difficulty. My metaphysical treatment changed the action of her belief on the lungs, and she never suffered again from east winds, but was restored to health. Page 184, line 27. I was called to visit Mr. Clark in Lynn, who had been confined to his bed 6 months with hip disease, caused by a fall upon a wooden spike when quite a boy. On entering the house, I met his physician, who said that the patient was dying. The physician had just probed the ulcer on the hip and said the bone was carious for several inches. He even showed me the probe which had on it the evidence of this condition of the bone. The doctor went out. Mr. Clark lay with his eyes fixed and sightless. The dew of death was on his brow. I went to his bedside. In a few moments, his face changed. Its death pallor gave place to a natural hue. The eyelids closed gently, and the breathing became natural. He was asleep. In about 10 minutes, he opened his eyes and said, "I feel like a new man. My suffering is all gone." It was between 3 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon when this took place. Page 192, line 32. I knew a person who, when quite a child, adopted the Graham system to cure dyspepsia. For many years, he ate only bread and vegetables and drank nothing but water. His dyspepsia increasing, he decided that his diet should be more rigid, and thereafter he partook of but one meal in 24 hours. This meal consisting of only a thin slice of bread without water. His physician also recommended that he should not wet his parched throat until 3 hours after eating. He passed many weary years in hunger and weakness, almost in starvation, and finally made up his mind to die, having exhausted the skill of the doctors, who kindly informed him that death was indeed his only alternative. At this point, Christian Science saved him, and he is now in perfect health without a vestige of the old complaint. Page 221, line 1. This was actually a healing of Mrs. Eddy, who at the time of the writing of Science and Health chose to represent the patient as a man for specific reasons. A case of convulsions produced by indigestion came under my observation. In her belief, the woman had chronic liver complaint, and was then suffering from a complication of symptoms connected with this belief. I cured her in a few minutes. One instant she spoke despairingly of herself. The next minute she said, "My food is all digested, and I should like something more to eat." Page 389, line 28. Shortly before Mrs. Eddy passed from the human scene, she had written an article titled Principle and Practice. Although this article was not published by her church until 7 years later, it is indicative of her prescience regarding the handling of errors that were at the base of the decline of her church, and illustrates the necessity and importance of true Christianly scientific healing. The nature and position of mortal mind are the opposite of immortal mind. The so-called mortal mind is belief and not understanding. Christian science requires understanding instead of belief. It is based on a fixed, eternal, and divine principle, wholly apart from mortal conjecture. And it must be understood, otherwise it cannot be correctly accepted and demonstrated. The inclination of mortal mind is to receive Christian science through a belief instead of the understanding. And this inclination prevails like an epidemic on the body. It inflames mortal mind and weakens the intellect. But this so-called mortal mind is wholly ignorant of this fact, and so cherishes its mere faith in Christian science. The sick, like drowning men, catch at whatever drifts toward them. The sick are told by a faith scientist, "I can heal you, for God is all, and you are well, since God creates neither sin, sickness, nor death." Such statements result in the sick either being healed by their faith in what you tell them, which heals only as a drug would heal, through belief, or in no effect whatever. If the faith healer succeeds in securing, kindling, the belief of the patient in his own recovery, the practitioner will have performed a faith cure, which he mistakenly pronounces Christian science. In this very manner, some students of Christian science have accepted, through faith, a divine principle, God, as their Savior. But they have not understood this principle sufficiently well to fulfill the scriptural commands, "Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel. Heal the sick." It is the healer's understanding of the operation of the divine principle and his application thereof which heals the sick, just as it is one's understanding of the principle of mathematics which enables him to demonstrate its rules. Christian science is not a faith cure. And unless human faith be distinguished from scientific healing, Christian science will again be lost from the practice of religion, as it was soon after the period of our great master's scientific teaching and practice. Preaching without practice of the divine principle of man's being has not, in 1900 years, resulted in demonstrating this principle. Preaching without the truthful and consistent practice of your statements will destroy the success of Christian science. The following 5 section headings are taken from Retrospection and Introspection, pages 24 to 39 by Mary Baker Eddy. The Great Discovery. It was in Massachusetts, in February 1866, and after the death of the magnetic doctor, Mr. P.P. Quimby, whom spiritualists would associate therewith, but who was in no wise connected with this event, that I discovered the science of divine metaphysical healing, which I afterwards named Christian Science. The discovery came to pass in this way. During 20 years prior to my discovery, I had been trying to trace all physical effects to a mental cause. And in the latter part of 1866, I gained the scientific certainty that all causation was mind, and every effect a mental phenomenon. My immediate recovery from the effects of an injury caused by an accident, an injury that neither medicine nor surgery could reach, was the falling apple that led me to the discovery how to be well myself and how to make others so. Even to the homeopathic physician who attended me and rejoiced in my recovery, I could not then explain the modus of my relief. I could only assure him that the divine spirit had wrought the miracle, a miracle which later I found to be in perfect scientific accord with divine law. I then withdrew from society about 3 years to ponder my mission, to search the scriptures, to find the science of mind that should take the things of God and show them to the creature, and reveal the great curative principle, deity. The Bible was my textbook. It answered my questions as to how I was healed. But the scriptures had to me a new meaning, a new tongue. Their spiritual signification appeared, and I apprehended for the first time, in their spiritual meaning, Jesus' teaching and demonstration, and the principle and rule of spiritual science and metaphysical healing, in a word, Christian Science. I named it Christian because it is compassionate, helpful, and spiritual. God I called Immortal Mind. That which sins, suffers, and dies, I named Mortal Mind. The physical senses, or sensuous nature, I called Error and Shadow. Soul I denominated Substance, because soul alone is truly substantial. God I characterized as individual entity, but his corporeality I denied. The real I claimed as eternal, and its antipodes, or the temporal, I described as unreal. Spirit I called the reality, and matter the unreality. I knew the human conception of God to be that he was a physically personal being, like unto man, and that the 5 physical senses are so many witnesses to the physical personality of mind and the real existence of matter. But I learned that these material senses testify falsely, that matter neither sees, hears, nor feels spirit, and is therefore inadequate to form any proper conception of the infinite mind. If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. John 5, verse 31. I beheld with ineffable awe our great Master's purpose in not questioning those he healed as to their disease or its symptoms, and his marvelous skill in demanding neither obedience to hygienic laws nor prescribing drugs to support the divine power which heals. Adoringly, I discern the principle of his holy heroism and Christian example on the cross, when he refused to drink the vinegar and gall, a preparation of poppy or aconite to allay the tortures of crucifixion. Our great way-shower, steadfast to the end in his obedience to God's laws, demonstrated for all time and peoples the supremacy of good over evil and the superiority of spirit over matter. The miracles recorded in the Bible, which had before seemed to me supernatural, grew divinely natural and apprehensible, though uninspired interpreters ignorantly pronounce Christ's healing miraculous, instead of seeing therein the operation of the divine law. Jesus of Nazareth was a natural and divine scientist. He was so before the material world saw him. He who antedated Abraham and gave the world a new date in the Christian era was a Christian scientist who needed no discovery of the science of being in order to rebuke the evidence. To one born of the flesh, however, divine science must be a discovery. Woman must give it birth. It must be begotten of spirituality, since none but the pure in heart can see God, the principle of all things pure, and none but the poor in spirit could first state this principle, could know yet more of the nothingness of matter and the allness of spirit, could utilize truth and absolutely reduce the demonstration of being in science to the apprehension of the age. I wrote also at this period comments on the scriptures, setting forth their spiritual interpretation, the science of the Bible, and so laid the foundation of my work called Science and Health, published in 1875. If these notes and comments, which have never been read by anyone but myself, were published, it would show that after my discovery of the absolute science of mind healing, like all great truths, this spiritual science developed itself to me, until Science and Health was written. These early comments are valuable to me as waymarks of progress, which I would not have effaced. Up to that time, I had not fully voiced my discovery. Naturally, my first jottings were but efforts to express, in feeble diction, truth's ultimate. In Longfellow's language, but the feeble hands and helpless, groping blindly in the darkness, touch God's right hand in that darkness, and are lifted up and strengthened. As sweet music ripples in one's first thoughts of it, like the brooklet in its meandering midst pebbles and rocks, before the mind can duly express it to the ear, so the harmony of divine science first broke upon my sense, before gathering experience and confidence to articulate it. Its natural manifestation is beautiful and euphonious, but its written expression increases in power and perfection under the guidance of the great master. The divine hand led me into a new world of light and life, a fresh universe, old to God, but new to his little one. It became evident that the divine mind alone must answer and be found as the life or principle of all being, and that one must acquaint himself with God if he would be at peace. He must be ours practically, guiding our every thought and action, else we cannot understand the omnipresence of good sufficiently to demonstrate, even in part, the science of the perfect mind and divine healing. I had learned that thought must be spiritualized in order to apprehend spirit. It must become honest, unselfish, and pure in order to have the least understanding of God in divine science. The first must become last. Our reliance upon material things must be transferred to a perception of and dependence on spiritual things. For spirit to be supreme in demonstration, it must be supreme in our affections, and we must be clad with divine power. Purity, self-renunciation, faith, and understanding must reduce all things real to their own mental denomination, mind, which divides, subdivides, increases, diminishes, constitutes, and sustains, according to the law of God. I had learned that mind reconstructed the body, and that nothing else could. How it was done, the spiritual science of mind must reveal. It was a mystery to me then, but I have since understood it. All science is a revelation. Its principle is divine, not human, reaching higher than the stars of heaven. Am I a believer in spiritualism? I believe in no-ism. This is my endeavor, to be a Christian, to assimilate the character and practice of the anointed, and no motive can cause a surrender of this effort. As I understand it, spiritualism is the antipode of Christian science. I esteem all honest people and love them, and hold to loving our enemies and doing good to them that despitefully use you and persecute you. Foundation work. As the pioneer of Christian science, I stood alone in this conflict, endeavoring to smite error with a falchion of truth. The rare bequests of Christian science are costly, and they have won fields of battle from which the dainty borrower would have fled. Ceaseless toil, self-renunciation, and love have cleared its pathway. The motive of my earliest labors has never changed. It was to relieve the sufferings of humanity by a sanitary system that should include all moral and religious reform. It is often asked why Christian science was revealed to me as one intelligence, analyzing, uncovering, and annihilating the false testimony of the physical senses. Why was this conviction necessary to the right apprehension of the invincible and infinite energies of truth and love, as contrasted with the foibles and fables of finite mind and material existence? The answer is plain. St. Paul declared that the law was the schoolmaster to bring him to Christ. even so was I led into the mazes of divine metaphysics through the gospel of suffering, the providence of God, and the cross of Christ. No one else can drain the cup which I have drunk to the dregs as the discoverer and teacher of Christian Science. Neither can its inspiration be gained without tasting this cup. The loss of material objects of affection sunders the dominant ties of earth and points to heaven. Nothing can compete with Christian Science and its demonstration in showing this solemn certainty in growing freedom and vindicating the ways of God to man. The absolute proof and self-evident propositions of truth are immeasurably paramount to rubric and dogma in proving the Christ. From my very childhood, I was impelled by a hunger and thirst after divine things, a desire for something higher and better than matter and apart from it, to seek diligently for the knowledge of God as the one great and ever-present relief from human woe. The first spontaneous motion of truth and love, acting through Christian Science on my roused consciousness, banished at once and forever the fundamental error of faith in things material. For this trust is the unseen sin, the unknown foe, the heart's untamed desire, which breaketh the divine commandments. As says St. James, "Whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, he is guilty of all." Into mortal mind's material obliquity I gazed, and stood abashed. Blanched was the cheek of pride. My heart bent low before the omnipotence of spirit, and a tint of humility, soft as the heart of a moonbeam, mantled the earth. Bethlehem and Bethany, Gethsemane and Calvary, spoke to my chastened sense, as by the tearful lips of a babe. Frozen fountains were unsealed, erudite systems of philosophy and religion melted, for love unveiled the healing promise and potency of a present spiritual afflatus. It was the gospel of healing, on its divinely appointed human mission, bearing on its white wings to my apprehension the beauty of holiness, even the possibilities of spiritual insight, knowledge, and being. Early had I learned that whatever is loved materially as mere corporeal personality is eventually lost. "For whosoever will save his life shall lose it," saith the Master. Exultant hope, if tinged with earthliness, is crushed as the moth. What is termed mortal and material existence is graphically defined by Calderon, the famous Spanish poet, who wrote, "What is life? 'Tis but a madness. What is life? A mere illusion. Fleeting pleasure, fond delusion. Short-lived joy that ends in sadness, whose most constant substance seems but the dream of other dreams." Medical experiments. The physical side of this research was aided by hints from homeopathy, sustaining my final conclusion that mortal belief instead of the drug governed the action of material medicine. I wandered through the dim mazes of Materia Medica till I was weary of scientific guessing, as it has been well called. I sought knowledge from the different schools, allopathy, homeopathy, hydropathy, electricity, and from various humbugs, but without receiving satisfaction. I found in the 262 remedies enumerated by Jar one pervading secret, namely, that the less material medicine we have, and the more mind, the better the work is done, a fact which seems to prove the principle of mind healing. One drop of the 30th attenuation of Natrum Muriaticum in a tumbler full of water, and one teaspoonful of the water mixed with the faith of ages, would cure patients not affected by a larger dose. The drug disappears in the higher attenuations of homeopathy, and matter is thereby rarefied to its fatal essence, mortal mind. But immortal mind, the curative principle, remains and is found to be even more active. The mental virtues of the material methods of medicine, when understood, were insufficient to satisfy my doubts as to the honesty or utility of using a material curative. I must know more of the unmixed, unerring source in order to gain the science of mind, the all-in-all of spirit, in which matter is obsolete. Nothing less could solve the mental problem. If I sought an answer from the medical schools, the reply was dark and contradictory. Neither ancient nor modern philosophy could clear the clouds or give me one distinct statement of the spiritual science of mind healing. Human reason was not equal to it. I claim for healing scientifically the following advantages. First, it does away with all material medicines and recognizes the antidote for all sickness as well as sin in the immortal mind, and mortal mind as the source of all the ills which befall mortals. Second, it is more effectual than drugs, and cures when they fail or only relieve, thus proving the superiority of metaphysics over physics. Third, a person healed by Christian Science is not only healed of his disease, but he is advanced morally and spiritually. The mortal body being but the objective state of the mortal mind, this mind must be renovated to improve the body. First publication. In 1870, I copyrighted the first publication on spiritual scientific mind healing, entitled The Science of Man. This little book is converted into the chapter on recapitulation in Science and Health. It was so new, the basis it laid down for physical and moral health was so hopelessly original, and men were so unfamiliar with the subject, that I did not venture upon its publication until later, having learned that the merits of Christian Science must be proven before a work on this subject could be profitably published. The truths of Christian Science are not interpolations of the Scriptures, but the spiritual interpretations thereof. Science is the prism of truth, which divides its rays and brings out the hues of deity. Human hypotheses have darkened the glow and grandeur of evangelical religion. When speaking of his true followers in every period, Jesus said, "They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover." There is no authority for querying the authenticity of this declaration, for it already was and is demonstrated as practical, and its claim is substantiated, a claim too eminent to fall to the ground beneath the stroke of artless workmen. Though a man were girt with the Urim and Thummim of priestly office, and denied the perpetuity of Jesus' command, "Heal the sick," or its application in all time to those who understand Christ as the truth and the life, that man would not expound the gospel according to Jesus. 5 years after taking out my first copyright, I taught the science of mind healing, alias Christian Science, by writing out my manuscripts for students and distributing them unsparingly. This will account for certain published and unpublished manuscripts extant, which the evil-minded would insinuate did not originate with me. The Precious Volume. The first edition of my most important work, Science and Health, containing the complete statement of Christian Science, the term employed by me to express the divine or spiritual science of mind healing, was published in 1875. When it was first printed, the critics took pleasure in saying, "This book is indeed wholly original, but it will never be read." The first edition numbered 1,000 copies. In September 1891, it had reached 62 editions. Those who formerly sneered at it as foolish and eccentric now declare, Bishop Berkeley, David Hume, Ralph Waldo Emerson, or certain German philosophers, to have been the originators of the science of mind healing, as therein stated. Even the scriptures gave no direct interpretation of the scientific basis for demonstrating the spiritual principle of healing, until our Heavenly Father saw fit, through the key to the scriptures in Science and Health, to unlock this mystery of godliness. My reluctance to give the public in my first edition of Science and Health, the chapter on animal magnetism, and the divine purpose that this should be done, may have an interest for the reader, and will be seen in the following circumstances. I had finished that edition as far as that chapter, when the printer informed me that he could not go on with my work. I had already paid him $700, and yet he stopped my work. All efforts to persuade him to finish my book were in vain. After months had passed, I yielded to a constant conviction that I must insert in my last chapter a partial history of what I had already observed of mental malpractice. Accordingly, I set to work, contrary to my inclination, to fulfill this painful task, and finished my copy for the book. As it afterwards appeared, although I had not thought of such a result, my printer resumed his work at the same time, finished printing the copy he had on hand, and then started for Lynn to see me. The afternoon that he left Boston for Lynn, I started for Boston with my finished copy. We met at the Eastern Depot in Lynn and were both surprised, I to learn that he had printed all the copy on hand, and had come to tell me he wanted more. He to find me en route for Boston to give him the closing chapter of my first edition of Science and Health. Not a word had passed between us, audibly or mentally, while this went on. I had grown disgusted with my printer and become silent. He had come to a standstill through motives and circumstances unknown to me. Science and Health is the textbook of Christian Science. Whosoever learns the letter of this book must also gain its spiritual significance in order to demonstrate Christian Science. When the demand for this book increased and people were healed simply by reading it, the copyright was infringed. I entered a suit at law, and my copyright was protected.